listener.
My next car will definitely be an EV.
I haven't been to a petrol station in months.
I have no idea how much electricity my car uses. All I know is that it's cheaper than petrol.
We talk a lot in this podcast about how EVs are the future of transport. And while that's true, it does raise an interesting question. Is the Australian electricity grid ready to move our nation?
I do like to think of myself as a sustainable person. But to be honest, I have no idea where the power to charge my car even comes from.
And as we see more and more electric cars on our roads, how can we achieve a more balanced approach to not only charging locations, but the energy sources that we're relying on?
Hi everybody, Greg Rust and Nadine Armstrong with you for another edition of What's Under the Bonnet. Today's episode is all about energy and charging. I know, we talk about charging all of the time, but in today's ep, we're talking about kind of a micro lens approach to the subject, zooming in and out of Australia's current and future energy landscape, all the way into the technology that can give you a little more freedom over what energy you use and when you can use it.
We've got Andrew Rogers from Charge HQ with us later in the show, and they're going to talk about sort of their breakthrough app, which allows users to switch between solar and grid consumption at the touch of a button, and a little something called charge priority limits.
And you want to stick with us for this episode too. We have Tim Washington coming on the program today. He's the founder and CEO of Jet Charge. If you've had a home charger installed, you might have heard of these guys, in fact. They're Australia's largest charging infrastructure company, designing and engineering everything from your classic home charger, the load management systems in apartment dwellings and so on, and large-scale public charging networks like Australia's longest EV highway. Bit more on that a little later.
But first, to give us that macro view on the energy landscape, we've got Tony Wood in studio. Tony is the Energy and Climate Change Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Tony, welcome to What's Under the Bonnet.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Can we just start off with a little bit about your experience in the energy industry?
I was a customer of the energy industry, and I got to a point where that was sort of, what am I going to do next? And someone said, do you want to come and look in the energy industry? And I said, well, that sounds pretty boring because nothing ever happens in the energy industry. All we do is dig up coal and make electricity, right? And fortunately for me, I thought through that and did join the energy industry. And it's been a great ride ever since.
We're basically, Tony, delving today into Australia's kind of changing energy landscape in many respects. What's happening out there is ultimately, as you've kind of suggested at the beginning there, going to impact us all at home. So we've already seen lots of change over the years with increases in supply from renewable sources like solar and wind. You've been working in this area, right, for quite some time. What have been the biggest changes you've seen or witnessed so far?
Starting almost at the home level has been the huge uptake of rooftop solar. I mean, Australia is the leading country in the world in the uptake of rooftop solar. There was a day, I think, in South Australia where there was more electricity being produced on the rooftops than Adelaide than was being consumed in Adelaide. Everything about that sounds positive and exciting. Well, it's not, because the industry has not dealt with, well, how do we deal with this? I mean, this is not the way the system used to work. Australia is unusual in the world that we just about have every source of energy you can think of, and sometimes having too much of everything, as we all know in other parts of our lives, we waste it. And we're not finished yet. We've still got some ways to go.
We know that our grid is supplied by a lot of different sources. What does the split look like currently in Australia? I mean, you talk about solar having huge uptake, but where does that fit in the overall landscape of where people are getting their electricity from?
So in Queensland and New South Wales, the majority of our electricity would produce from coal. When you get to Victoria, on the other hand, we have this stuff called brown coal, which is more accurately described as mud, which is will eventually become coal in a couple of billion years, but it's the same thing, but it's at a very much earlier stage of its compression and development. And it has almost no other value except to make electricity. It produces a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, but it's been very, very cheap. Tasmania and South Australia, on the other hand, dominated today by renewable energy. And so you've seen this very different mix. Across Australia, we're now in a situation where wind and solar are responsible for about 35% of our electricity. That's grown from 10% less than 20 years ago, and we're heading north from there. At the same time, gas, even though coal-fired power stations have been shutting, The big loser has been gas because it's the most expensive, and gas and coal are being pushed out by renewables.
If you kind of look at the different options, how does cost stack up? So is solar that much cheaper than hydro, for example, for the same kind of electricity output? And then, you know, throw wind and solar into that question too.
When you look at the actual cost of generating electricity at the point of production, whether that's on your rooftop for solar, whether it's at the point where the wind farms are operating, or it's in the Latrobe Valley where the coal-fired power stations are, there's no doubt today that wind and solar particularly, is the cheapest form of electricity. The problem is that most of us don't live in the Latrobe Valley and we don't live near these wind and solar farms. And so what happens here is the cost of transmitting that electricity is contributing to the overall system cost of delivering that electricity to our homes. And where we've been lacking in dealing with these technologies, we understand that at the point of production, they're very low cost and have come down dramatically over the last 20 years. But when we integrate that into our system, that's where life gets complicated, because whilst coal is more expensive, particularly if you want to build new coal-fired power stations, and gas is the most expensive of the ones we're talking about, dealing with the mixture to ensure that we reduce emissions, we maintain reliability, and it also remains affordable means we've got to stay within certain boundaries, and that means managing the mix. And that's a much more challenging thing to say, well, let's have the cheapest.
Let's go to the government. And are they doing enough to encourage this?
Go back to the beginning of the century, when Kevin Rudd took over as Prime Minister, he had a very strong commitment to address climate change. And unfortunately, ever since then, climate change, probably more than just about more than any other country in the world, this has been a politically partisan debate. People have written books in Australia called The Climate War. When Albanese got elected, he said, we're going to end the climate war. Well, that hasn't happened. So it's been a very polarising debate in Australia. And as a consequence of that, it's been very difficult to get governments to have clear policy which stays in place. And while we have seen climate policies come and go, Australia's tried on more climate policies than any other country in the world, but we've discarded almost all of them. We're not very good at that. And as a consequence of that, even though we have made significant progress in the move to move from fossil fuels to renewables, it's been very stop-start, it's been very unpredictable, and it's been very badly coordinated across the states. And the federal government at times has been helpful, at times not. And we've now got discoordinated or uncoordinated policies in this area. And one of the areas we have to get better at is coordinating our policy so that we don't end up duplicating things and we end up with the lowest cost system.
Can we talk EVs for a second? Obviously, there was a doubling of vehicle sales in this country between 2022 and 2023 and so on. One of the things we covered in last season, our first season of the podcast, What's Under the Bonnet, was can the grid cope? How are we going in terms of the uptake on these and the grid dealing with that?
We have not yet been getting on top of two things. One is building out the charging infrastructure, because I think it's still a bit unclear as to what will be the role of charging stations. I think we know there will not be the traditional way of fueling your car by going to a thing called a service station. Most of the time, most of us will charge our electric vehicles either at home or on the footpath outside our home if we haven't got off-street parking or whatever, right? Or even at work. Every now and again, however, we'll want to travel a bit further than that. And we have this dream in Australia, even though 40% of Australians living in Sydney and Melbourne, we don't travel actually all that much. When we do, we've got this idea that we travel big distances across a big country. And that's when things can get tough with EV infrastructure. So we haven't been building that out fast enough. The other side of it, which is creeping up on us and will creep up on us faster than we've thought about, is whereabouts do we have to fundamentally increase the capacity of the system? So whether that means apartment buildings, and I've got that problem where I live, or whether it's going to be at roadhouses, if you start having a huge number of vehicles, particularly with these things called fast chargers, charging vehicles all at once, then the grid will not have the capacity to deal with that at the local level. Most of the time so far it's okay, but what level of uptake can we seriously expect? And if we do that, can we make sure that our charging system is in front of that?
In your opinion, does the split looking forward, what is it going to look like in 2030? Do we need to be all solar or wind, a combination? What do you think there?
We're at 35% now. The government is desperately trying to accelerate to move towards their current target, which is 82% renewable by 2030. I think that's going to be hard, not because renewables are expensive, but because we are finding it very difficult to build out the transmission grid. So now we have to build a new grid. it won't surprise you to know that some people, for some reason, don't think that electricity transmission towers are the most attractive thing they've ever seen. And that's a big battle. It's taking place right now in regional Victoria, regional New South Wales, and landowners particularly are pushing back big time. The bigger challenge becomes when we get into the 80%, 90% renewable. They are intermittent. We do have to deal with what happens when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. That comes back to that question of storage. Is pumped hydro the best answer? Is having a small amount of gas in the system the right answer? Is hydrogen the right answer? Or even is nuclear the right answer? I mean, the combination, I think, for that last 10% is the most difficult challenge. In the longer term, the more immediate challenge is how we build out that transmission grid to get to that level of renewables.
Tony, can I pick up on something you said a minute ago? Because I think our listeners would want us to explore this with you. And you used the word with a question mark around nuclear. And I know you have contributed to this discussion before and whether Australia should or shouldn't consider this. What is your take on that topic?
I've got a sort of a yes, but answer to that question, because as we get towards very high levels of renewables, we do have this challenge of what's there to deal with. The German term is Dunkelflaute, and that basically, I'm told, means the dark doldrums. That's when we have at nighttime and low wind output. What do we have for those situations? We have to have electricity that's accessible. And of course, you know, God in her wisdom put all the coal and gas there, and we've just been getting it out for free, basically. Now we've got to think about how do we create energy which we then have when we need it. Do we store electricity in some form as pumped hydro? Do we store it as gas? Whatever, right? So that's the big question. Now, amongst that, people who have looked around the world would say, why don't we have a conversation about nuclear? The arguments that I've got against nuclear as a simple solution are not so much about weapons or waste, or the most images people have of nuclear as Chernobyl or Three Mile Island or Fukushima. There is a fundamental issue is economics. Right now, nuclear power stations only come in one size. That's extra, 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 extra large, and they're eye-wateringly expensive. And, you know, there are people, including people in the current federal opposition, who would argue, well, what about small modular reactors? If we made them in factories, just one after the other, after the other, after the other, would the cost come down? Maybe, if we ever did that. We've not done it yet. These are reactors that being a tenth of the size of a current coal-fired power station, instead of three or four times the size, which most of the big nuclear power stations being built today look like. So could we make them in factories and run down the cost? Maybe. Therefore, I think I've got two provisos here. Firstly, we have a ban on nuclear power at the moment. It is illegal to make electricity from nuclear. The only nuclear reactor we have in the country is in Sydney. Basically, it's produced radioactive isotopes for medical purposes. I don't understand why we have this ban, because I think making it illegal just antagonizes those who want to have a sensible conversation about the potential role of nuclear. If they made it legal tomorrow, no one would go and build a nuclear power station because the economics are so bad. Now, will that change? There are two things that could happen that would cause that to change. Both of them would have to happen before nuclear becomes a realistic proposition. One is our current plan, which is renewables and some sort of backup, proves to be really expensive and really hard. The backup doesn't become very clear, or it's very expensive. And the other one is that the cost of small modular nuclear reactors comes down dramatically. 20 years ago, the cost of solar was 10 times what it is today. So I wouldn't rule that out, but it's proving to be quite difficult. For Australia, the best strategy, in my view, is to stay on the track we are now. And maybe in 20 or 30 years' time, if small modular reactors do emerge, that'll be what we replace our wind farms and solar farms with when they reach the end of their life. Because recycling all the material in all these solar farms and wind farms itself will be a non-trivial problem. So I think there's a potential role for nuclear. We need to think about it. We need to think about it in an adult way, understand what role it could play. And it certainly doesn't sort of enter my current thinking about where we have to go.
We asked earlier a little bit about what the energy landscape might look like in terms of, you know, where we're sourcing it from. And we're also talking to Tim Washington from Jet Charge, who's, you know, one of the big players for infrastructure in Australia. And one of their big projects has been helping to electrify over 5,000 kilometres, a highway essentially, in WA. Does the remoteness of a project like that lend itself to a particular electricity source, like, you know, solar, for example, over there? You know, how much does the geography play a part in these decisions?
A lot is the simple answer. It raises a slightly separate question but related one about the moment we get electricity to places like Stuart Highway up from Adelaide to Darwin or across to Perth, sometimes we have local generators, sometimes it's just transmission lines that are strung a long way, and that's enough because the electrical needs of a roadhouse on the Nullarbor Plains are not all that high. Basically, you can do that by stringing electricity cables along that distance, right? We now know that as courtesy of understanding more about solar and batteries, we can probably do it on site. So I think we're going to see a mixture of those two. I don't think it's going to be all one or all the other, but I think the idea of having remote communities where they're off the grid, they have solar, they have batteries, they might even have a small diesel generator just when they really need it, right? Which doesn't run very much, doesn't produce many emissions, but make sure that they've got electricity when they need it. I think those things are going to happen. And in that world, you've got a very different system. It also opens up a separate question, which is not so much about the passenger and other light vehicles, commercial vehicles, but about heavy vehicles. Whether or not battery electric vehicles is going to be the way forward, or whether more likely we're going to see hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. And that raises a much more complicated issue about how you supply hydrogen to some of these remote areas. That may be a conversation for another time.
And just to wrap up, what does the average kind of EV driver, the people who charge at home really the majority of the time, need to think of, be aware of when it comes to how they charge in the future?
If the future goes the way I would like to think it goes, they'll need to think about it less rather than more. If we get to the situation where the system starts to groan a bit, when hundreds of thousands of me are doing exactly that same thing at 6 o'clock in the evening, that's going to be a challenge, right? We are seeing very progressive companies at the front end of this with a relatively simple system that could interface our car charging system with the electricity grid, possibly even the rest of our house. So this system could then sit there effectively as a computer running our house, and it would make decisions to optimize when to charge that car. So we are going to see control technology interfacing with energy technology in a way that's going to be a big change for all of us.
Tony, this has been fascinating. I feel like we've peeled the onion significantly here, and we've had some great insights from you, and we're absolutely thrilled for our audience. Very grateful that you've come into studio today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Now, of course, when we're having a conversation about charging and the future of powering our cars, it makes sense to chat with someone at the centre of that universe, right? Because as our energy habits change along with our grid, so too does the technology. Now, joining us is the founder and CEO of JetCharge, one of Australia's largest EV charging technology developers. They make all sorts of things from chargers, of course, but also bespoke payment terminals, innovative solutions for bidirectional charging as well. So let's get an idea of how charging technology is influencing and changing with our future. Tim Washington from JetCharge, hello and welcome to What's Under the Bonnet.
Thanks, Rusty. Great to be with you.
Can we start by getting a little bit of background about JetCharge and just for our audience, what you guys do?
We are an end-to-end provider of EV charging solutions. So what that means is anything from home charging all the way up to like big buses and trucks and public charging networks. We're the ones who come in, do the engineering, supply the hardware, manage the installation, write the software for it, do the maintenance, and then integrate that into the grid and help to facilitate payments.
Our guest earlier on the podcast gave us some really interesting insights into the future of Australia's energy market in terms of things like renewables and costs and infrastructure. But speaking of that infrastructure, we want to talk about the great project you've been working on at JetCharge, which is Australia's longest EV highway. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Australia's longest EV highway is in Western Australia. What the WA government did through their two electricity providers, their Synergy and Horizon Power, is to say, you know what? If we really want to embrace electric cars, people need to be able to drive the entirety of the great state of Western Australia. And so one of the great things, and these sites just went live, is that there are these off-grid sites where they combine solar, battery, and EV charging to ensure that even in places with almost no electricity, people can charge their car. JetCharge's involvement in that was we essentially supplied all the technology for the entire highway, as well as, I think probably more importantly, the energy management systems that control all of those things, so coordinate between solar and battery and charger, as well as the credit card payment terminals.
WA is a massive place. That's an obvious statement I've just made. And there's obviously some very, you know, remote parts of it. Does the geography create some challenges around these sort of installations? And what are you doing in and around that? I mean, is something like solar a factor and so on?
Yeah, it creates challenges in kind of three ways. The first is getting enough power, because sometimes the charging stations will draw more electricity than the entire community draws. And so solar and battery has to be part of the solution, because you can't take power away from these communities, so you need to add power in. The second challenge that it represents is in relation to the actual installation phase. It's not just about, the installer forgot something so they can drive back and go to wherever, Bunnings, and grab a replacement. It's like a three-hour drive from the closest, small airport. The installation phase requires an incredible amount of coordination. And then the last bit is maintenance. Maintenance is so difficult. And I always say this, which is that the less used a public charging station is, the more it needs to be maintained, because chances are that charging station is in a remote area. And whilst it may see very little use, the people who need to use it really need to use it. So all of those things are hard, but we're solving them one by one. But really what's great is that more and more governments and state and both federal government are basically saying, hey, if you're going to put out these charging stations, we need to make sure that you hit an uptime guarantee. How do we maintain them? We try and work to a metric which we call uptime, which essentially means that every time someone goes there, they can expect it to be working. And the times when it's not working are basically when we're doing planned maintenance.
Tim, I'm really interested to know around that whole maintenance side. Is all of that hands-on stuff at location, or is some of that over the air? How does that work in terms of like fixing something?
Yeah, so I can let you in on some industry secrets if you want.
Yes, please.
We're all ears.
So maintenance for electric vehicle charging, the reason it's tough is because it is a combination of hardware knowledge, software knowledge, not only software knowledge, but what we call firmware knowledge. So basically what firmware version is the charger running. If there's energy management on site, like JetCharge Core, you need to understand that. And then networking, as well as technology and electrical. It's all of those things. There is an absolute disconnect between people who manage the hardware, the software, and electrical field services, not only in Australia, but globally. And one of JetCharge's main aims is to unify all of those things so that there is a one-stop shop, not only a service provider like us, but a technology provider who can unify all of those things. And that's what we are building.
Tim, this ep is all about the future of charging, right, and how that integrates with Australia's ever-changing grid structure. We wanted to talk about an exciting piece of tech that you've got at JetCharge called Core. What can you tell us about that? Just shed a bit of light on it.
What JetCharge Core does, and we started developing this technology 5 years ago because we looked around the world and nobody was developing it. You measure the site demand in real time. So you basically say, hey, what's the site consuming? What's the building consuming? Is it at its limit? If it's at its limit, we limit the charge rate. And then as everyone goes to sleep at night and as the building's electricity usage falls, all of the vehicles that are plugged in, the charge rate ramps up. But then we're starting to integrate batteries. We're starting to integrate solar. And we're starting to integrate basically wider grid assets so that EV charging can actually benefit the grid rather than add stress to it. And there's changes coming for our building sector where every new building needs to have one of these energy management systems. So we're really hoping to lead the country on making sure that EV charging contributes rather than harms the grid.
When you're designing a home charger generally, what are you and kind of the engineers thinking about? Are you focused on the user experience? Is it a highly technical and complicated thing? And how do you sort of simplify that and make it intuitive?
Home charging is really simple. The complicated part is what role does home charging play in the wider electricity grid when everyone has electric vehicles? And the biggest challenge for us as an industry is that consumers don't care about how they contribute to the wider electricity grid, nor should they really have to care. And so whilst home charging is simple, because it's so simple, it basically means more and more electricity load onto the grid. And so therefore, for those of us who do care about how the grid operates, because it affects all of us, how do we design products? How do we design user experiences that starts to align like EV drivers' interests with the grid interests? I don't actually think everyone's got that worked out yet, but there are lots and lots of companies and smart people working on it. And we're hoping to basically have all of these solutions in the market before EV take-up approaches escape velocity. But if someone wants to charge their vehicle at home, it's simple.
You know, we started talking about the fact that the vast majority of people will be charging at home, but we know that with increased public infrastructure, the tech's getting better and faster. Do you think people are going to change how they charge? Are they not going to rely on home charging as much?
I actually think that people will rely on home charging more. 70% of Australians who have a car have access to off-street parking, which is an incredibly high amount. It also costs 50% cheaper to almost 100% cheaper if you're using your solar to charge at home compared to public charging. You just need to do one thought experiment. If you said to people today, I can charge your mobile phone in 3 minutes, but you're not allowed to charge your mobile phone at home or at work, you have to charge it at a petrol station, would people elect to get rid of their home charging capability for their phone or their work charging capability for their phone and go to a petrol station every time they want to charge their mobile phone? And if the answer is no, then electric vehicles are exactly the same. The fact that you can charge it at home or at work is an absolute game changer for people, especially when it's much cheaper, and especially when they're able to take that electricity and put it back into their home.
You're a player in Australia's kind of commercial charging space, right? So what do you see as the biggest challenge as we shift more towards, you know, renewable power in the coming years?
I think the greatest challenges are to come up with commercial models that encourage regional and rural public charging deployment. I think everybody has this sense that a lot of people make a lot of money from charging electric vehicles. The answer is almost everyone is losing money on providing public charging. And that's especially the case in regional and rural areas. And inevitably, we all know, living in the society that we live in, if the business case is hard, then there's only so much time that companies will invest to basically put it out there. So I ultimately think, my personal view, is that regional and rural charging probably needs to be something that requires government involvement long term, kind of like those black spot programs or those regional rural kind of transport programs. The second major challenge is going to be, how do we deal with apartments? Over 40% of people who live in Sydney live in an apartment. If we don't solve apartment charging, we won't solve the EV uptake issue. And if you say to apartment EV owners that they have to go charging public, essentially, then what you're saying to those apartment owners is, we expect you to pay twice as much for EV charging as someone who can afford a house, which from JetCharge's perspective and from an equity perspective is not good enough. And then there are some very, very niche ones, which your listeners probably won't be interested in, around how do we electrify whole truck and bus depots when those depots, each depot, takes the same amount of electricity as a university or a hospital. That's a big challenge.
Tim Washington, it's been fabulous to catch up again. We enjoyed that at the EV show last year. Thank you for coming on the pod today.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Andrew Rogers, co-founder of Charge HQ. Lots of good stuff that we wanted to talk to him about, from charge priority limits to bi-directional charging and a whole lot more. Welcome to What's Under the Bonnet.
Thanks for having me.
Can you pretend for us that we have never heard of Charge HQ before? This is your chance to kind of give us your elevator pitch.
So Charge HQ is an app that lets EV owners charge from their rooftop solar rather than sending that excess solar to the grid. When you're not really getting paid for it, Charge HQ diverts that into your EV.
Love that, because solar is something that a lot of EV owners talk about. So, you know, how did the idea for Charge HQ come about? Are you an EV driver? Is that what was, you know, making you do this?
Yeah. So I was a really early Tesla owner, and I'd always had solar on my roof. And I kind of saw these two systems. I was making solar during the day and I was exporting it. And then I was charging from the grid overnight. And it's like, well, why can't these two things talk to each other? Like, but the car's on the internet and the solar's on the internet. It's actually my co-founder, Jay, who's a software developer. And he had the same thought and thought, well, why don't I just build something? And so he did. And he put something together. And then he shared what he'd built on some Facebook groups. People started using it and telling their friends. And so we got that experience and saw some of the problems that the system was trying to deal with. And both pretty passionate about EVs and renewables and putting it all together as they just build this.
Andrew, we know that with solar, the home will use the solar first, right, before switching to the grid. So what if it's been a cloudy day and you come home with, I don't know, only 20% charge? Do you just have to use the grid in that example?
one of the clever things about the app is that because we know that level of charge on the vehicle, we say, okay, well, you do need charge the next day. So we'll charge the vehicle up to, say, only 50% overnight. And it does take it from the grid. But by stopping at 50% means you've got enough charge to get you around the next day. But then if the sun does come out that following day, then you can fill the car up the rest of the way with solar. And so you sort of get the best of both worlds there.
So maybe let's take a step back. So say someone has rooftop solar and, for example, a Tesla charger at home, they download the HQ app, then what comes next? Talk us through, you know, that process.
One of the really nice things about this is there's no hardware to install. In about 10 minutes, you can set it all up on your own. You kind of just log in and you give it access to your Tesla account, and then you log into your solar app and you do the same thing. You give it access to your solar account, and then it starts collecting the data from both of those systems. And you can kind of stop at that point and it'll start charging your car from solar. It does have some really nice charging stats in it that you can watch. And each day or month, you can sort of see how much of your EV energy and your charging's now come from your solar or from the grid.
So you've recently introduced charge priority limits. What are they? And what are the benefits of doing that?
We let users sort of say if they want their home battery to charge first or the EV to charge first. And then people started saying, no, I want it to be flexible. And so we built it. And what happened is if you set that limit to a lower level and you say, let the home battery charge up to, say, 50% first and then let the EV start charging, the home battery is a bit faster and responds quickly. And so the two things now start to work together in harmony. The user ends up with both a fully charged EV and a home battery at the end of the day.
Among the myriad of things that you do in your role, you recently also wrote a blog post on electricity tariffs' impact on timing on EVs. What did you find there?
Yeah, so we're collecting a lot of data about charging profiles. And from our time in the industry, we knew that a lot of the people in the energy system are really worried about what's going to happen when everyone gets an EV and they come home and they plug it in at night and they all start charging at the same time. And it becomes a bit like this air conditioner problem where you overload the grid. But what we can see in the data is that's not what's really happening. And in this case, in South Australia and Western Australia, there's already these energy tariffs where they give you really cheap power in the middle of the day. And so when we look at this data, we can see that it's shifting the user behavior. And so when we look at the charging profiles from those states and we compare them to the eastern states, we see a lot more charging happening during the middle of the day. And that tells us if you give people tools like ChargeHQ that make it easy to charge from solar, or if you just give them an energy tariff where it's cheap to charge from solar, then people will do that. And so the exciting thing here is that now the EVs can play this really important role where you can start to use them to soak up all this excess solar. And the important thing here is it really does need to be simple. If you want to try and get your hot water and your pool and your heating and your battery to all talk to each other, that just gets really hard and complicated and expensive. But once you electrify your home, you know, your hot water and your swimming pool, you can make them really efficient, and some simple tools like time clocks work really well. You only need to add some smarts on around your EV and your home battery, and you can get this really efficient use of this solar energy.
Bidirectional charging is still something that's very new in our part of the world, right? Very much in its infancy. As someone who's in the industry, does BDC excite you? What are your thoughts on this? And we've got to remember, of course, too, that it's only really available in South Australia. Only certain cars can use it, and so on.
Yeah, it's certainly early days. I'm happy to be wrong. Personally, I think charging the EV from the solar is going to be a big thing, but then taking it back out to power your home or export it to the grid, I worry it's just going to wear your battery out if you do a lot of it. And then if you don't do much of it, then you're probably not going to pay for that extra cost of putting all that kit in.
Andrew, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Thank you very, very much for coming on What's Under the Bonnet today and sharing a bit of your story and some insights.
Awesome. Great to chat, Rusty.
We're done. That is it for this episode. I don't know about you, but every time that we do an episode of What's Under the Bonnet relating to charging or battery tech, it gets more complex. But also I found myself today more eyes open, more engaged on this whole subject. There's some great things in today's episode. We've almost put a bit of a lab coat on, haven't we?
The advancement in this area is, over a short time, it's pretty astonishing when you think about
staggering.
It. I found Tim Washington fascinating. I could listen to him all day long because he really breaks it down. He makes something that is really, really complex, quite simple to understand.
It really does. Don't forget to keep an eye out as well for the Watt Report in a fortnight's time. So keep an eye out for notifications on that. On behalf of Nadine and all of our team, that's bye for now. Listener.